This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast. Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElrath.
Yeah, we've been banging on for weeks now about how great this time of year is and how wonderful the wildlife is in Scotland. And I've been up to Loch Strathbeg in the northeast of Scotland to see the amazing sight of 1,000 lapwings. Wonderful.
That's a fabulous sight. I can't remember the last time I saw more than about 20.
Yeah, they're lovely birds, peewits, chuggets. A lot of people thought they were on the brink of extinction, but they're making a great comeback, so that's a wee bit later in the programme.
Okay, looking forward to that. Steve Mitchell has been farming buffalo and fife since 2005. You might recognise him from the BBC television series This Farming Life. Now, he's had a dream for some time to expand from buffalo beef, which is what he does, into mozzarella production, which would make him Scotland's only buffalo mozzarella producer. Earlier this week, he reached a fundraising target which theoretically should help him make that dream a reality. I went to meet him on his farm near Kirkcaldy and to learn more about the humble buffalo.
A lot of people think they'll be much bigger than cows. They're quite similar in size to normal cattle, but distinctive features being their horns. They live a lot longer than cattle. They've had them now for will be 15 years this coming year, and we are very excited. Hopefully this time next year we will have our own milking herd of buffalo. We've always intended to kind of get to. The buffalo produce a fantastic quality of milk that lends itself to making amazing products, most famously the buffalo mozzarella.
These animals in front of us, this is the kind of thing you would see in an Asian paddy field. You know, I mean, they are leggier, I would say, than the cattle that you normally see here. In terms of the mozzarella, how on earth, I mean, they've got really serious horns on them, how do you go about milking something like this?
Well, fortunately, we're not milking from their heads, we're milking from between their legs. And actually,
the
amazing thing about buffalo is that one of the things that they've been really bred for is not to kick. Right. So,
really?
Yeah, because they've got these horns, their attack is to turn around and defend with their heads, whereas cattle tend to defend with their feet. Yeah. And you'd be amazed to know that 14% of the total milk consumed in this world comes from buffalo. Huh? It's not that clever an idea, if I'm honest, because it's something that's working fantastically well across the world. Just so happens it's not really taking off in Scotland, and yet seems so wrong that it hasn't, because we are renowned for our amazing grass. So I think we're doing something very, very sensible that's going to work really well here.
Okay, so you've raised a fair sum of money, £800,000. What for?
So, yeah, we've launched our Founders Club, which has been us sort of engaging with our customers. The reason for that was we were kind of let down by an investor. And it was quite a disheartening period for me. It was quite public because we were being filmed by the BBC for This Farming Life at the time. But we decided not to give up. The fundamentals were it's a great project. So we asked our customers if they wanted to get involved. We want to establish a herd of buffalo for milking. At the moment, this farm is a beef farm. We don't have the facilities. So the money has been raised to build a factory which will process the milk. It will make mozzarella. It will make ice cream. It will make ricotta. And we're also planning to bottle this buffalo milk from this factory. And we're making a lovely new shed for our animals, not on this site, but a site closer to Kirkcaldy. It was traditionally a dairy farm back in the day, so it's got all the laneways, the topography of the site, it's just perfect for dairy farming, and we just cannot wait to make this dream become reality.
Explain what a laneway is.
A laneway is a track that obviously the animals go out to graze every day. You want to bring them back to the parlour to milk them morning and night, and these are quite integral to making a dairy farm work, because you see, you walk animals over the same bit of ground every day, it'll get poached, and their feet will, you know, they'll be walking in mud. We want them to walk on tracks so that nobody likes walking in mud.
In terms of making buffalo mozzarella, is that protected in any way? Do you need anyone's permission to make that stuff?
Well, no, it's not a... I'm not going to try the Italian version of saying it, but no, we can definitely make Scottish buffalo mozzarella. It's working incredibly well for a guy who's inspired me a lot over in Ireland. He just won the World Gold Cheese Awards with his mozzarella down in Cork. So I reckon if it can work in Ireland, it can work here in Fife.
How long do you think it's going to take you before you've got something in your hand that you can actually eat?
Well, the next few days and weeks are going to be integral to that. We're just at the point of appointing our contractor. We are still slightly at the mercy of our planning authority, so we're just waiting on hearing that back. But as soon as we get that planning permission in place, we want to have everything ready to press the button. From pressing the button, we would hope 4 months construction, and obviously we're dealing with livestock, which brings with it its own unpredictabilities in terms of, in order to get milk, we have to have animals at calving at a particular time, etc., etc. So there's a lot of variables in there, but we're targeting next summer, because of our Founders Club and the way we've raised this money. It's quite important to me also that it is a good investment, so to speak. They're getting a 10%, some of them are actually getting a 12% in return of their investment, but it's in produce that I produce and sell from our shop or service in our cafe or our event catering. So they're getting that annually, and then they get the money back at the end. But during that four-year period where we have their money, I feel it's really important that we make it fun for them. That's how we've gone about marketing this and talking about it. So we've organised a buff in the barn. Don't worry, you don't have to get
the
naked.
The phrase "hostage to fortune" springs to mind.
Well, we did this for charity 5 years ago on our 10th birthday, and we've decided that this would be a great occasion to have another buff in the barn. And it would be really, really nice if I can make sure we've got some mozzarella to go on top of these burgers or pizzas. So that's the target. Obviously, from a business point of view, the minute we start, the sooner we can get product to sell, the easier it is in the cash flow.
We're standing in front of your beef animals at the moment. Do you have a dairy herd waiting in the wings just ready to jump into position?
No, although the animals to the left here are actually young calves that I brought in from Holland. We are also intending to try and upgrade some of the younger generation of these cows, so that the heifers, we over the last 10 years have, you know, been working slowly towards it. So the bulls I've been using have been more and more milking, and that's the big thing about it. We're not changing completely what we're doing. We're still going to have a bull calf every year. We'll still be doing the meat side of things. In fact, the mozzarella is as much great as it's going to be. It's actually going to really improve the profitability of what we're doing at the moment. Something that was quite important to me when we first got the buffalo was establishing the meat side of the business, because I think it's maybe a weakness in conventional dairy that they've gone so extreme into the milk, whereas the buffalo is a real dual purpose beast. So our costs will go up slightly to produce the calves when they're not suckling their mother, but the return that we get for that milk will far outweigh that. In fact, the overall profitability of our business is going to be really improved by this. But we will keep working the sort of two herds together. I think it's just really exciting what we've got in front of us.
Buffalo farmer Steve Mitchell there, and I'm indebted to him for pointing out where you actually milk a buffalo.
Yes, there's so much to learn.
So much to learn, so little time to do it.
How long you lived in a farm?
See, I mean, you've seen buffalo. I mean, they have got big horns.
They
need to watch
them. They have big things. I've certainly come across Steve's stuff at the Edinburgh Farmers Market. Mm-hmm. And if you could get some mozzarella, that'd be a great thing to have in breakfast on a Saturday morning.
Very nice too.
Now, when you think about the Kintyre Peninsula, the many things spring to mind, but space travel isn't one of them. But that could be about to change after the Macrahanish Air Base Community Company was awarded funding from the UK Space Agency to explore exactly that, launching spacecraft. Malcolm McMillan is the Business Development Manager with MAC, and he told me about the background.
We are here at Macrahanish Air Base, now known as Macrahanish Business Park.
And we're on the runway at the airport. It's a massive runway.
It is. It's over 3,000 metres long, and it's over 46 metres wide, and the site itself is over 1,000 acres.
So what was the history of this place? When did it start? What was it built for?
It originally was built in 1916, a much smaller scale, a crisscross runway rather than just the one runway we have today. And it was really for pilot training by the Navy at the time. And then in 1918, after the RAF was formed, they took over the site. And again, it was pilot training right up until just after the Korean War. After that, kind of Cold War started to heat up. This site became strategically important for NATO. And at that point, it received massive investment, including the building of the runway, which is over 3,000 metres long.
Well, why is it so long? It's 3 kilometres. It's huge.
It is huge. The reason it was that it's that long is really because at the time, the UK's nuclear deterrent was through the V bomber force, and it was built to accommodate that, as well as transatlantic aircraft from the US coming over, which needed the length at the time to stop in wet conditions, etc.
So how many folk would have been based here? Because it's almost impossible to get the scale of this. I've said it before, it's massive.
It is. At its peak, 1,500, but during normal operations, you're talking about kind of 700, 800 people would have been based from the site. That's contractors, military personnel, and civilians who were on the site too.
So when the RAF pulled out, it must have been a major economic impact.
It was massive. It happened over a kind of progressive time. So in 1996, it was formally put into care and maintenance. It wound down massively at that point. There was still some activity on the site in terms of just looking after it, even though the place was virtually empty for about 20 years.
And the community got the chance to buy it very cheaply.
Yes, we did. It was a bit fraught. Originally, the airbase was put on for sale in 2008. The Macrahanish Air Base Community Company was formed in the same year, in 2008, and it took 4 years of negotiation with the MOD, with the Scottish Government and with public sector partners in order to actually facilitate the sale, and we eventually bought it for the princely sum of £1.
Now, that might seem as a bargain, but it's a huge leap of faith for a community to buy what potentially is a huge liability.
Yes, it took some really fantastic vision from the board and a huge amount of determination and support from the local community to do that. I mean, the site's over 1,000 acres. It's got its own high voltage electricity system, 22 substations, 36 kilometres of water pipe. It's got 18 kilometres of road as well as the runway. It's got over 220 buildings on it as well as its own water and sewerage works.
You've got many plans in the pipeline, but you've just had some exciting funding which could put this place into space.
It could. We've been delighted to get some funding from the UK Space Agency. This is one of the shortlisted sites for a horizontal launch spaceport in the UK, and we've received money to start developing our plans for that.
So that would be kind of big plane with a rocket on the bottom?
Indeed it is, yes, or something similar. We're looking kind of not in the immediate future, we're looking kind of medium, kind of 2025 to 2030 and beyond, to see what's potentially going to be launched from the site. So that could be a variety of different aircraft. It could be single stage to orbit aircraft, it could be high altitude platforms. We don't know yet. That's part of what the work we're going to do is to find out.
Is there a demand for that?
Definitely. There's definitely a demand for putting things in space, and it's only increasing. All the market research points to a massive explosion of small satellites needing to go into space. And so the UK is positioning itself to enable that.
But that could be a massive impact. I mean, yeah, it's early days yet. It could have a huge impact on Campbelltown and the surrounding area.
It could be transformational. We're a bit pragmatic, we have to be, so we're just making sure that we don't get ahead of ourselves. But if it could come off, there is some real opportunity for some substantial investment.
Fantastically exciting if it did happen.
It would be incredibly exciting, absolutely brilliant.
Malcolm McMillan at the Macrahanish Air Base. And you started off that piece by saying, you know, you wouldn't think about space adventure from Campbelltown, but actually, I'm fairly certain it was an alternate landing site for the space shuttle. If things went wrong, that runway's big enough that it could have got it down and got it back out again in one piece.
Yeah, not anymore, because the big chunk of it isn't maintained. So Logan Air use a wee tiny bit at the bottom.
The Kimberless land sideways on it.
Yeah, and then they fence the rest of it off. But it's such, you know, it's huge. You're just looking down it, you can hardly see the end. Exciting stuff.
Very fond memories of going through security at the airport in Macrahanish.
Aye,
it's basically like a garden shed.
Aye, but there isn't any security now.
Really?
No.
They got rid of it?
No, there was security there, but they don't check your bags or anything.
No, I think, oh.
Are you, hey, you.
On you go.
Didn't even need a ticket. It was great. I loved it. 15 minutes from Campbell. I mean, that's the odd thing about it. If you don't know the geography, it's at the bottom of Argyll, mm-hmm. and it's 15 minutes on the plane from Glasgow, or something like 6 hours by car.
Yeah, it's, well, just a slight exaggeration, but certainly it's a fair while. It's 100 miles down the Kintyre Peninsula, and you've got to get to the top of the Kintyre Peninsula first.
Well, it takes about 3 hours to do that 100 miles.
I know.
Anyway, because it's a touched on it, it's a part of the world that really needs a helping hand, and wish them every success.
You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. We know people listen to this all around the world. We like hearing where you listen to this. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Dorothy Gillett did. She said,
"My husband and I live in a part of Spain which is very similar to Scotland. We're in a beautiful region called Asturias and the Cantabrian coast. So exactly the opposite end of the country from the costas of the Med."
She goes on, "My husband's from Clydeside. I love your country. So every week we tune into the Out of Doors podcast, generally on a Sunday morning. There's so much in common with where we live. Apart from the temperature. It's below freezing this morning here. The mountains, the coast, the way of life, oodles of wildlife. You can hear the robin in the background. A real appreciation of local cultures and home-reared food. Great to be reminded that such things are valued by so many people in Scotland."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Your mozzarella.
If only we had mozzarella. Cutting down on single-use plastic and food waste are topics we've looked at quite a lot in our radio programme Out of Doors, and obviously in the podcast Scotland Outdoors. Very keen to hear any hints or tips, any smart things you've come across, you know, stuff that's easy to do that would actually make a difference. Recently I visited a shop in Lossiemouth up in Moray that's opened with the purpose of providing folk with the option of shopping in such a way that basically, you don't have to have any single-use plastic in your basket.
You didn't want any bread today, did you? There's one white loaf and some rolls left.
Oh, is there?
Yes.
I'm Alison, and I've been running the Restore here in Lossiemouth for about 6 weeks, so fairly new, but it's been in the planning for the last 6 to 8 months. And I guess it just came from the fact that I was frustrated with the amount of packaging everywhere you go, whether it's supermarkets or just general, the amount of single-use plastic. And I've been brought up by the sea, I've always lived by the sea, but a walk on the beach isn't what it used to be now because I'm constantly picking up plastic.
How does this get set up? Because essentially, it looks to me as if it's been custom designed to do the job.
There's a few companies now popping up because these shops are so popular where you can buy these dispensers. But the shelving was actually made locally by a girl called Deb at Funky Furbish. So she made a great job of using reclaimed scaffolding.
I thought it was scaffolding.
Yeah, it looks amazing. It does. But the actual dispensers themselves are custom made for exactly this type of shop.
You've got a really quite extraordinary range. I mean, just the top line, jumbo oats, pinhead oatmeal, muesli, white grain rice, long grain rice, arborio, white basmati, etc., sunflower kernels, broth mix, split peas, red lentils, you know, and people just come in here with the jars and fill them up and then weigh them in the system in the corner.
Yeah, pretty much. It's great. I mean, you know, initially I have to quite often show people how to use the system, but now I've got loads of customers that are coming back and they're just bringing in big bags full of their own containers, and it can be anything. It doesn't matter if it's a plastic container, Tupperware, plastic bags, as long as you're reusing it.
Thank you.
I'm Jo. This is our second time here. We've come back with lots of empty containers to fill up, haven't we?
Okay, and who's this young gentleman?
This is my son. What's your name?
Baxter.
Right, okay, fair enough.
So we're here to just fill up on cupboard essentials, basically.
Okay,
so
show me how this works, because I want to see the weighing
machine. We've done the first part, so we've put it on.
And weighed your container.
Weighed the container, and it prints off the little label, and we put it here.
Okay.
Yeah, right, so what do we do now?
If I can get it open.
Of course you can.
Well, maybe just pour it all in, actually, will we?
You want all of the spaghetti?
Yep.
Okay, fair enough.
We put it all in.
You've clicked, I have a filled container to weigh.
Yep, so we need to scan it first, take the weight off of that, I think.
There we go.
There we go.
That's it, you scan.
And then we put it on the scales, and then we pick where we've been. So what are we needing? It's pasta?
Yep.
Let's see if we can find spaghetti.
I can't see. Oh, there it is.
Can you see it? Oh, yeah.
Took me really well to spot it.
Right down the bottom?
Second spaghetti. Row right at the bottom.
Good. And then it just tells you how much it is. can take it and we stick it on for Alison to scan.
So basically, that's it. You weigh the container first.
Yep.
Put the stuff in the container, weigh it again, it subtracts the weight of the container and what have you, and it's saying that you've got 61 pence worth of spaghetti in there.
Yep. Easy peasy.
Why? Why are you doing this?
Myself, I'm vegan. My daughter's vegetarian. We're very trying to be more environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. And the amount of plastic and single-use plastic is just ridiculous. So we're trying to be more environmentally friendly. Yeah, and we make a lot of stuff anyway ourselves. I bake. And it seems the next step.
Across here, you've got things like laundry products, toilet cleaning stuff, a lovely line in toilet paper called Who Gives a Crap? That's nice.
People love that. And they've got a Christmas range now too, so you don't even have to wrap it. You just give it. Yeah.
Yes, it's the thought that counts, basically, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So where does all this stuff come from? And it's because it's all presumably got green credentials.
Yes, that's one thing of the business that I didn't predict was that how hard it was going to be to source things and all the research that has to be done in it. I mean, thank goodness for Google, but also that kind of opens up a huge variety of different wholesalers, different sellers. What I try and do is I shop local where I can. Yeah. So all my vegetables are local. I have local apple juice, honey, all sorts. And the UK where possible. So at the moment, this is a Northamptonshire-based company that I use. They're a small family-run company. I am in talks just now with a girl in Aberdeenshire who does cleaning products. So hopefully I'll be stocking them soon as well.
I'm Jennifer. I was delighted to see this on Facebook, this shop. And I came in just to have a look round a couple of weeks ago. And I couldn't believe my eyes. Look at all those grains and everything else that you might want. Not in plastic bags.
I expected, you know, the quinoa and the couscous and everything else, but what I didn't expect was the range of other stuff that they have.
Exactly. Exactly, because I was surprised too. In fact, I didn't even see everything that was in the shop because there's so much. Yeah. No, all the spice jars and herbs, and then all the toiletries and things for the kitchen. You know, all the things you need for washing, cleaning and everything. Yeah. And all these lovely bits of toiletries as well.
My name is Jana, and I come here because it's a great little shop with lots of stuff that helps us reduce waste, because I can get things here without the plastic packaging, obviously.
It seems like such a simple idea. It's strange that there's not more of them.
Absolutely. Yes, I think there should be more of them. It's very convenient for us as well, because we live just across the road. But I've heard that there are people coming here from neighbouring towns and villages. So, yeah, it's really good.
Okay, now, easy. I mean, you're just loading up basically rolls at the moment in a brown paper bag. That's fair enough.
Yes.
When it comes to things like liquids, what do?
I just bring my bottles and jars. I just have my container for conditioner over there.
Okay.
And that's it. You know, I get conditioner here, shampoo, washing up liquid for the dishes. You have all those containers at home already because you have bought products previously, so when you run out, you just bring them over.
Jana, one of the customers at Alison Rookby's shop, the Restore in Lossiemouth.
Is he still in the clock back?
Yeah, absolutely.
When I grew up, I lived in a wee village
called Milk.
No, okay, it was a wee village called Innerwick, and it was just in a time zone.
Uh-huh.
And the butter was in a barrel. And you got it in greaseproof, honestly. And you got it in greaseproof paper, and the biscuits were in big tin boxes about a foot square.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it was great. Nothing wrong with that. And you take your milk and you take the bottle back, and it's just turning the clock back. I mean, you think about it, we didn't have plastic 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, true.
And it's just everywhere. We don't need it.
Mm. Yeah, but prior to plastic, we had Bakelite, and the smell of hot Bakelite. One smell never forgotten.
Is a thing that we could live without.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you've done stuff on making plastic materials or a plastic-like material from leftover...
Well, it's crab shell.
Crab shell and...
It's chitin, basically.
And langoustine.
Yes, yeah.
And it's got huge antibacterial properties. So there are other things out there. Mm. It's just that plastic, I think, has been too easy up until now.
Far too easy. On a similar theme, a couple of weeks ago, Laura Guthrie visited a project in Blair Gowrie that was helping people cut down on their energy use, but at the same time, and this is quite clever, trying to encourage sustainable shopping.
Another part of the HEAT project was setting up a local loyalty scheme and also an online platform for selling local produce, which is called Neighbour Food. It's an online platform where local producers upload any of their products onto the platform. And the market opens on a Thursday afternoon, and it's opened until a Tuesday midnight. And consumers basically go on, pick the produce that they want to purchase, and all the producers then delivers the produce to the Heat Project. And we distribute it then through Well Meadow House in Blairgarry between 4 and 7 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon and Thursday evening. And that has been proven really popular amongst producers and the consumers, and people are really, really keen on supporting and basically purchasing products and produce from our local area. It's a great way to be able to do it.
Do you think it's just a case of before that, people just aren't aware necessarily about what's going on locally, because they're so used to just nipping to the supermarket or, you know, doing online shopping and never thinking about what's on their doorstep?
When we were doing a lot of our research into what the local area would like, a lot was around, time was an issue. We don't live locally. How do we get the produce? And also producers, how do we get our produce to the market as well? So this was a really good way of catching people that are working out of town and providing a service to them, that they're able to come in, because a lot of the time the shops are closed when they're coming back from where they work. Also making it that little bit easier for people to be able to purchase that local produce.
Nolene Chapman there from the Heat Project in Blairgowrie.
At the risk of having another rant.
Surely not.
Well, there's a lot of brown paper bags been appearing in supermarkets recently, mm-hmm. which is great, mm-hmm. but they put a cellophane insert into it.
Which but they have to, because otherwise they have to open the bag at the top and see what's
no,
in
no,
it.
No, these are open bags. Like if you're mm-hmm. buying your mushrooms or you're mm-hmm. buying your loose vegetables, mm-hmm. it's got a cellophane panel in it. So to recycle it, you have to rip that out and put it in different bins. You can't recycle the both of them together. It's ridiculous.
I must confess, when I'm busy lobbing stuff into our recycling bin at the moment, and that's some plastics, that's paper, that's cardboard, that's tins, and I'm thinking, who's sorting this out? Where is it getting sorted out? What happens to it afterwards?
Well, maybe you should go and find out.
Yeah, quite probably.
The other one's glass. I don't know where you live. My part of the world in Aberdeenshire, they recycle everything at the doorstep, but not glass. To recycle. Well, you know, you don't have a glass recycle. You can't put glass in the recycling bin. For that, you have to drive to a recycling place. Mm-hmm. Anyway, rant over.
Last week, we were extolling the virtues of winter. We were down at Calaverick. We were talking to a guy called Stephen Rutt, who's got a lovely book out called Wintering. We were talking to a fellow called David Borthwick, who's, you know, basically, he was saying he is a dark halfer. He prefers the winter time. Winter's his preferred season.
Yeah, have you got a chance to go and download the podcast on that one? Because it was great. Anyway, at the other end of the country, I was up at the RSPB Loch of Strathbeg Reserve for some more winter wildlife watching in the company of Assistant Warden Kat Szuszewska.
I just think just the sounds of Strathbeg in winter is just something really special to behold. We have the hooper swans and we've got, at the moment, a large flock of lapwing.
I just bowled up here a couple of minutes ago and was knocked out by that sight in front of us in terms of the lapwing. It's just gorgeous, isn't it? What are they doing?
They're quite flighty, our lapwing, so if they get spooked, they all tend to fly up together, so it almost looks like a murmuration sometimes. I think it does, yeah. Then they'll settle back down again. They're a lot more flighty than obviously like the swans and the geese we get.
It's just you're talking about a murmuration there. It's just like a shoal of fish. I'm useless at counting, but I'm 200? What would you say?
At least 200, yep. We've had counts of about around 1,000 across the whole of the reserve.
Because that's one of the things that people talk about. It was one of the great sites, you know, around the time of the First World War in the northeast of Scotland or in the north of Scotland, were massive flocks of lapwing. And sadly, that has gone pretty much, but obviously not here.
Yeah, the Loch Strathbeg is a good wintering ground for the lapwing here.
And you get that lovely twisting and turning, as I say, and you get that lovely flash of white when they all turn in unison, and you get that that silhouette.
Yeah, really acrobatic almost, and the way they fly is really obvious. So once you've seen a lapwing, you'll know what it is the next time you see one.
Because usually up until recently, I've only seen them in kind of twos and threes in the field. So I thought they were going to disappear.
They tend to gather in winter in large flocks, but in the summer, obviously, they all spread out to breed.
And every now and again, they're coming down to, is that mudflats there?
It's like island, like raised bits which have got higher land level than...
We've got the swans coming in as well. And yeah. There's no terns here at the moment, but you built a tern. It's not a raft, is it? A tern island.
It's a tern island, yes.
So it's an artificial island with a... Is it to keep out badgers, foxes?
Otters.
Otters?
Yeah, with them predating on tern chicks.
So how successful has it been?
It has been amazingly successful. We used to get around 10 pairs. There's been well over 100.
Wow.
Pairs of terns this year.
And it's just lovely just listening to that. Let's have a second.
Oh, curlew.
It is a curlew, isn't it?
Yep, there's a curlew somewhere.
We were down at Carlaverock the other week and just listening to the whooper swans and the geese and just that wall of noise, but you're chucking in curlew and lapwing, and what else have you got out there?
We've had good numbers of ducks this winter as well, so you get widgeon, teal, quite large flocks of widgeon this year.
How easy are they to see? I mean, it's all very well being in the visitor centre and looking through the plate glass. I mean, how close can you get to the birds? Because you've got a couple of newish hides up here as well.
We do, and our new Dunbar hide obviously is a lot closer to the pools out on low ground, so you can get closer up views. And you can see things by eye sometimes from there as well, which is really good.
You did touch on it. The lapwing all go down en masse, and then suddenly, woof, they're back up in the air again. What would spook them?
Whether it's a potential predator or whether something to do with the weather might put them up either, but yeah, they tend to do this for the majority of the time.
It's just wonderful, there's that seething mass of birds. It's wonderful. Do you have any idea why they like it here?
Well, at this time of year, we have our water levels quite high, and they like to feed on muddy edges.
So lots to see.
Definitely. Who needs a television when you can just stand outside and just watch nature?
Kat Soszewska, the assistant warden at Locker Strathblegh. And the bird itself, the lapwing, wonderful animal. Its Latin name, as a Linnaean name, Vanellus vanellus, means little fan, because of the way it kind of flips
just
through the air.
Just twitches all the way through, yeah. Isn't it? It just flips around.
I remember the nesting season, many, many years ago, cycling along a road, and I obviously went too close to the nest. It was the other side of the fence.
Had I got you?
No, the bird followed me, complaining. Looking behind me, it was literally only about 6 feet away. It's the best view of a lapwing I've ever had in my life.
Beautiful birds. They've got really quite square wings and a delightful crest, like a cockatoo almost. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah, nice stuff. Anyway, Wanderings and Windings is the rather poetic, lovely title for a new series of trails around Stirling, Falkirk, Fife and Clackmannanshire. They've been set up by the Inner Forth Futures Project. I went for a bit of a wander along one of them with project manager Sue Walker and asked her, have you actually come up with these routes?
It was brilliant, actually. We got some money from the Heritage Lottery Fund, and a key part of that was to make sure that these 9 routes that we've developed were developed with the local communities. And we went round to 8 different locations all around the Inner Forth, invited lots of people to come along who are keen on the local area, on the heritage, like walking or cycling. And we took some massive maps around with us. And we basically asked people to show us where their favourite places were, where their favourite routes were. Sometimes the places that, you know, they look good on a map, but actually they're overgrown or they're muddy. And we got them all together, lots and lots of post-it notes. I think we got shares and post-it notes in the end. And it was amazing, the buzz and the chat that developed. You know, people who had never talked to each other in the local community about it before would say, oh yeah, this is a great place, and oh, don't forget to put this place on. So that all the stuff that's in here now is based on local people's favourite places. So that's what we think makes our routes a little bit unique and really exciting.
Where we're walking through at the moment, I mean, this is autumn time, obviously, going into winter. So the path is covered in leaves. Good standing on the path, top marks for that. But at the side, you've got brambles, you've got elder, you've got the tail end of Himalayan balsam here on the left-hand side. This could get very overgrown. You can set up a path. Who maintains it?
The council have agreed to maintain them. We put them in. This path here used to be quite a rough, muddy track. Yeah. During the
More
time...
More of a canoe route than anything else.
Sometimes, I think. Yeah. During the time when we were working as in a fourth landscape initiative, one of our projects was to improve this path, and the hard standing that you mentioned was part of that. We did several of them all around the Inner Forth, and the local authorities have now taken on the maintenance and afterwards. I mean, it's fair to say, though, that not all our routes are fantastic, easy walking like this, and they're not meant to be. the routes that we've devised are for people who are looking for a little bit more adventure, if you like, mini adventure. So some of the bits are muddy, some of the winding routes, there's quite hilly bits, and they're day-long routes. They're not just an afternoon stroll, although you can pick shorter bits and do them. What we're trying to say is you don't have to go an hour's drive away to get some fantastic landscape, heritage, wildlife. It's on your doorstep, and you can get there without using a car. You can use all our routes start from train stations, so you can get there on the train, you can get there on the bus.
Define day route. How long is a day route?
So this is a good question, and something that we talked about quite long, because obviously one person's 2 or 3 hour cycle is another person's sort of day-long cycle, etc. And in the end, we kept it as quite a loose definition. So our routes in distance, the shortest one is about 12 miles. The longest one is 76 miles.
What?
So
that's not a day route, unless you've got a motorbike.
Well, we have cyclists who would easily do that in a day. Most of the routes that are longer, so there's quite a number of the routes that are sort of 30 to 40 miles, but we've designed them so that there are shortcuts, so you can split it into 2 or 3 days for walking if you want to do that. Basically taking the route and deciding what a day route means to you.
The reason we turned off the path back there, it's basically hung a right, is because this is incredibly unusual. Getting access to the River Forth along its length, I mean, you'd think it was dead straightforward, but it's not.
No, there aren't that many places where you can get right close to the edge of it like this. It's been shut out by industry, by development, by farming, and so, no, there aren't that many places. And this is why, I mean, I brought you to this route, because this is a special place for me, a really favourite place. And, you know, the weather today, it's not classically beautiful weather. It's a bit misty and cool. But it's soft. And you look across the river here and you can see this is Banditha over the other side. It looks a bit like a sort of mini village. It's about 36 old warehouses where they kept munitions in the Second World War. And if you get over to that side of the river, it's quite a sort of spooky and quite sort of unusual experience to walk round it all. But just to look across from here, and you can see gulls and waders sort of flying across the incredibly calm water today.
It's incredibly calm water, and where we're standing, I mean, to get across to that old munitions dump, it must be about 200 metres, 250 metres of water. It is wide here, but there's such a feeling of strength from that.
Absolutely, yes, and it's still tidal here, and in fact it's tidal all the way up to Stirling. But you come here when the tide is out, and there's large quantities of mud each side and just a sort of trickle in the middle, effectively. But that mud itself is incredibly important as well. That's where the waders feed. That's where things are roosting and taking refuge. So this river is really the lifeblood of the whole area, certainly from a wildlife point of view.
How do folk find out about these walks then?
The 9 routes, we've got leaflets for all of them, and they're available on our website to download. If you go to innerforthlandscape.co.uk, and then it's the Wanderings and Windings web page. There's also GPX files for all of the routes.
What's GPX?
It's a navigational tool.
Something on your mobile phone, basically.
You can download it onto your mobile phone or your GPS, and it will help you to navigate around the route. But we do suggest that people also use an OS map at the same time. This particular route, Birding for Bike, which is what we're on at the moment, it has 4 different wildlife sites on the route that you can go past. If you're cycling, you can do it in a day. If you were walking, you might want to take a couple of days over it. Although, if you were really fit and keen on a long summer day, you might be able to make an epic out of it.
The trouble is, if there's too many birds, you spend all your time watching that. It takes weeks.
Yes, that's true.
Sue Walker, Project Officer with Inner Forth Futures. So, 76 miles, one of the routes.
I did a double take with...
What?
Well, I think the most I've done is 44 in a day. And
that was before you got that electric bike.
That was true. Oh, I suppose we could cycle the 76 miles.
Wait, you're going to walk.
Sorry, I thought you were walking.
No, I'd be daft. I'd be on a bike, for the love of goodness. Here at the BBC in Aberdeen, staff have been trying to do their bit to respond to concerns about the impact of climate change. A green team's been established here with the aim of cutting our carbon footprint and just trying to increase biodiversity a wee bit around the building.
Yeah, it's kind of relevant because we here at the said in the BBC in Aberdeen, we've got the environment correspondent, we've got Kevin Keane, we've got Out of Doors, we've got Landward, our television programme. We produce here the bulk of BBC Scotland's environmental output.
Now, our very own senior producer, Helen Needham, is at the helm of that group, and her particular focus is on creating a wildflower meadow in our garden here. She took some advice from Alex Stewart and Ewan Cameron of the North East Scotland Biodiversity Partnership.
We're in an area here with a number of mature trees, beech trees, chestnut and so on. Underneath that, down at ground level, it's a bit of grass, but it's mostly moss. And your gardener colleagues would probably tell you they need to get rid of your moss, but that's nonsense. If you're interested in biodiversity, there's nothing wrong with moss. And in a place like this, we certainly would be encouraging people to grow more wildflowers. Wildflowers are good because, unlike garden varieties, they produce lots of nectar and pollen, which is great for pollinating insects. And of course, the pollinating insects that come here will visit your neighbour's gardens and pollinate their soft fruit. Everybody wins.
I'm absolutely delighted to hear you say that about moss, because I'm a great fan of moss, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people listening who think, hooray, I've won the argument, actually, in my household.
But I think the other great thing about this is that in amongst the moss and what have you, if it's not intensively managed and people aren't chucking herbicides and what have you on it, there'll be lots of wee creepy crawlies and other beasties. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you had a hedgehog living in this garden. And again, hedgehogs are having a tough time. They need good habitat, places where they can live, places where they can overwinter, and places where they can find food to eat. And if you want to control the slugs in your garden, get a hedgehog.
Looking specifically at this area, because what I'd really like is to have a sense of a wildflower type meadow, but you're thinking on a more sort of micro scale, not tall plants, actually, let's keep it low to the ground.
Yes, I think a lot of people find the idea of wildflower areas, they're not very keen on them because they think they're going to get jungly and untidy and, you know, full of rats and goodness knows all what. One way around that is to focus on low-growing plants. And certainly in a situation like this where you've got some shade, it's not dead flat like most lawns. It's a bit up and down. So there'll be some bits that are drier, some bits that are wetter. And there are lots of plants that you could have growing in here, native wild plants. And that's anything from clover, bird's foot trefoil, wild thyme. These things wouldn't grow much more than about 10 centimetres tall, or 4 inches in Old Money if you're still that way. You would only need to cut it once a year. It would look fantastic. It would be a great source of food for pollinating insects like native bumblebees, moths, hoverflies, all these sorts of things that are under huge pressure and have seen huge declines in the last 50, 60, 70 years. So again, it's another win-win.
Let's get to the practicalities then. How do I go about doing this?
There are different options. One thing you can do is you can scrape the ground or disturb the ground a little bit, expose some bare soil and just scatter some wildflower seed. The other alternative is to buy small plant plugs of native plants and just plant them in amongst the sward. And if you, again, the moss is very useful because where you've got a patch of nothing but moss, the moss isn't going to grow very big. So the plant plugs that you put in there aren't going to be competing with grasses. And nature always helps. And there is another fantastic plant called yellow rattle, and it's a semi-parasite on grasses. So it doesn't kill off the grass, but it suppresses it. It stops it getting huge and tall. So those are the two main options.
Alex, any advice then when and how I should go about doing this?
wildflower seed sowing tends to either be done early springtime or late summer. So you're talking September or around about April time for the year. If it's something like yellow rattle, that needs to be done in September because it needs a long frost period for it to help germinate. But other things can be done throughout the year. You can have later plantings of flowers depending on the type of seed mix that you use. You just need to see what's right for the area. There's not a one-size-fits-all kind of scheme that goes along.
Probably should wait till the spring then before I get this project underway.
Possibly. I was thinking about other things that you could be doing. So there's things like bulb planting, where maybe just slightly past that time of year, although you could probably still get some in the ground. Things like crocus are really wonderful for early pollinators coming out. They're one of the first flowers that comes out, and especially if they're native crocus, then they have lots of pollen and nectar for everyone. So, yeah.
One thought that occurred to me that might be a nice way is to set up a project with local schools and get the schools to raise plug plants, and then they can come and help you plant them out in the spring or whatever's the most appropriate time. That's a nice community venture, you know. It's people collaborating and helping one another. There are lots of community groups out there now, whether it could be schools, it could be a youth club, it could be an allotment association, it could be a men's shed. I mean, there are just so many groups like that who I'm sure would love to work with you on a project like this.
Because it does have, as you've been pointed out already, a wider benefit for the community.
Definitely. So as well as for the nature in the surrounding area, creating a really good habitat for things like pollinators and other insect species, other small mammals as well, there's definite improvements. I know from working with volunteer groups in the past, there's a real vast improvement with mental health from getting outside, doing about 25 minutes of gardening a week, I think was the recommended amount. It improves community spirit. I think it lifts people's spirits just in general, walking past an area that has lots of wildlife and interesting things growing. I don't get that same feeling from looking at a manicured lawn.
Alex Stewart and Ewan Cameron of the North East Scotland Biodiversity Partnership talking to Helen Needham there.
But he's absolutely right. I mean, so many, even roundabouts in the cities, You'd rather see a carpet of wildflowers or apple trees rather than corporate planting.
Tell you who's good for that, Fife.
Fife, yes.
Yeah, Fife are really good at that. They've got wildflowers all over the place. Some beautiful shows of flowers, actually, during the summertime.
When you think about it, there's so much wasted space that has got this corporate planting when it could just be, you know, a bit of wild. You don't want to have apples because you don't want people crossing the busy road to go and get them.
True.
But there are many parts of many cities and parks. You could have pear trees, you could have apple trees, you could have cherry trees.
Yeah.
And somebody said to me once, I asked him about that, and he said, well, you're not worried the kids are going to go up there and steal the apples? And he said, well, you know, that's exactly what I want them to do.
Yeah.
They don't have to eat them. Yeah. Just, in, you know, if I'm getting a kid climbing a tree, That's a success.
Exactly. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us, as ever. We will be back next week with another edition, but until then, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.